This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. To those of us who watched and worked with Bob Inman during his days as the primary anchor for WBTV News, his second career as a novelist came, at least initially, as a surprise. Most of us didn't know he had a bent for fiction. In fact, those in the newsroom hoped he didn't. But he met with such success with his very first novel, Home Fires Burning, for which he was asked to write the screenplay for a Hallmark Hall of Fame special called The Summer of Ben Tyler. Well, the rest is history. Since that time, he's written four more novels, many screenplays for network TV, several stage plays, including a musical, and nonfiction as well. In short, Bob Inman's second career has been even more successful than his first. And now he's out with his latest novel, The Governor's Lady, and he joins us to talk about that and more. It is very good to see you again, Bob Inman. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be here. I really appreciate you having me on.
For those of you who remember Bob on television, he would never have worn that on TV. It's got
No, but you know, my last night on Channel 3 at 11 o'clock, I'd already said my goodbye piece at 6 o'clock. And at 11 o'clock, as the newscast was ending, I said, you know, you've always wondered what anchor people wear below the waist because you never see them below the waist. And I stood up and the camera got me in my Bermuda shorts, and yeah. I just love that.
People didn't know that, particularly in the summertime. Even the weather people on television will wear shorts or they'll wear jeans with their jacket because you really don't see them much below the button of the jacket.
Exactly.
So if they ever have to pull out with the camera, you're in real trouble. You know, for a guy who spent, I don't know, years writing and delivering TV news, and then you branched out. And when you branched out. Novels, nonfiction, plays, musicals, screenplays. Where did all this come from?
Storytelling. Journalism storytelling. That was always my approach. In our newsroom, you know, here at Channel 3, I used to say, you know, if you tell stories about people, then people who are watching you can understand what's going on. Put it in a personal term. So storytelling, it just came naturally to me. I grew up with a mother who read to me when I was an infant and in a large, rowdy, storytelling South Alabama family, and it's just part of who I am.
But where do the stories come from? I mean, each story that you've written a book about is very different from the other stories that you've written about.
All very different.
And I'm curious, does it start with a character that pops into your head? Wouldn't it be interesting if this character, like you did a book about a TV weatherman. What could I do with a TV weatherman? Or does it start with the situation that the TV weatherman finds himself in? Or in this case, the governor's lady, does it start with the fact, it wouldn't be interesting to write about a woman who becomes governor after her husband's been governor and her mother was the first lady of the state earlier and is obsessed with politics but not with family. Wouldn't that be interesting? Where does it begin?
It begins with a character. I have to imagine a central character that I'm really interested in, that intrigues me, put that character in a particular time and place, surround that character with other characters, know just enough about that character to get started, know what the situation is, and give that character a dilemma, a central dilemma, which is both external and internal, something that the character wrestles with in life, out in life, and something the character's wrestling with within, in this case, her own soul. And that's where it starts.
Do you plot all this out ahead of time on an outline? You just start.
I don't outline.
So do you find yourself when you just start? You have this character and some characters around this character and a situation and a dilemma. Do you then find yourself writing down dark alleys that dead end and you have to go back and change things? Or is it does it just come out?
Well, I'm scared to death for one thing because I don't know how it's going to come out. But no, if I've got the character in place and I've got and the situation in place and I understand that, then I've learned to trust my characters to lead me through the story. They really do take on a life of their own, and I just have to trust them. And if I do, if I stay with them, if I trust them, if I go visit them every day, then they will lead me through the story. Of course, I know a few big things that might happen during the story, but then I have to be open to possibility. And if I am, then things work out.
Do you do a lot of rewriting? Or do you just write it?
Well, sure. I mean, what I try to do, I had a great fiction teacher in graduate school, a novelist named Barry Hanna. And Barry used to say, for the first draft, just blast it. Just get through it. Put it all down on paper as you understand it now. And then go back and work on it and edit it and rewrite it and make it better. And that's what I do. I rewrite a lot, but I try to get it all down first.
You know, in the earlier days when people hand wrote everything or began to type everything, there were rough drafts that were left behind where things were a writer would sit down, write it out, then scratch things out, and substitute words, put things in the margins, and he would send that off to the publisher and it would get published the way he intended in the final draft. Today, everything's done on a computer, so we don't get to see the process that a writer maybe has gone through. What's your take on that? Because some people bemoan the fact that in 100 years, people will look back at contemporary fiction today, some of the great contemporary fiction, and not be able to figure out the process.
You don't want to see sausage being made either.
Why not?
Because it's a messy, sloppy process, and that's what writing is, especially for somebody like me who doesn't follow a carefully plotted outline. But I saved all the drafts. I mean, I've got files in my computer that were all the drafts. But you see the finished product, which is the way it's always been. But the drafts are there, and all the corrections I've made and the changes. I've got notes from my editors about, you know, things that I might want to work on. And that's all there, but it's not, and it's on paper somewhere. You know, I've got stacks, reams of paper, but you see the finished product.
Talk about that relationship with an editor, because this is your baby. This is your story. These are your characters. You've done all the work on this, and then you send it off to your editor who works for the publisher, and his job or her job is to make sure that the book that is ultimately published is something that's going to sell.
Right, exactly.
So what's that relationship like? Because they do make suggestions. They do point out things that maybe you didn't see, or maybe they point out things about the book or the story that you really don't want to change.
Well, I've been very fortunate to have to work with terrific editors who really look at the story as a whole. They see the forest. And they can pick out the trees, but they see the forest. And they point out things to me that I can do to focus the story and illuminate the character better. And they suggest that. But in every case, my editors have always said, this is your book, your story, and you have to decide what to do with it. I've worked with one editor. I partially dedicated the book to him, a guy named Bill Phillips, who when I started out with Home Fires Burning was the editor-in-chief at Little Brown. He's the guy that made the decision to buy the book. And Bill has worked with me on all five novels. Now, Bill's not with Little Brown anymore, and this book, this new book, is not with Little Brown. I worked again with a terrific editor at John F. Blair Publishers named Steve Kirk. And in every case, they say, here are some things I think you need to consider. Here are some big items, some big issues. And I look at those, and it always triggers some ideas in my own mind about how to address that and make the book better. Mm. And these two editors on this book have done a wonderful job of suggesting to me and opening up my creative process.
You have written plays, and as a result of that, you've worked with actors and directors who are staging the plays that you have written. Would you compare what an editor does for a writer to what a director does for an actor?
It's more like a producer, I think, who's working in the development process. You've done theater, and you know how the development process takes place with a new play. Mm-hmm. And I've done that seven times with plays, been through the development process. And the producer, like an editor, like a producer with a play, is suggesting how the development process might go forward.
But producers are snakes. You know that, right?
Well, they're also people with the money a lot of times.
I'm just kidding.
And editors are, too. They're the ones who make the decisions about whether to buy this book.
I'm just kidding. Now you've written in different formats. You've written novels. You've written plays. You've written a musical. You've written screenplays. Does the story dictate the form for you, or how does it work? How do you know that this is a play but not a novel, or this is a novel but not a play, or this could be both? How do you know that?
Well, it's all storytelling, and all stories are about people, and it all starts with character. Now, every form that I've worked in, every genre, has a different, what I call a different language about how the story is told. Home Fires Burning started as a book, and then it became a movie. And it was my job in doing the script for the movie to find the language that would tell that big sprawling book in a two-hour made-for-television movie, actually an hour and a half when you take the commercials out. So you're working with the language of the film or of the theater. With a book, you get to go inside the head, the heart, the soul of the characters. And I love doing that with a novel. But then you have to externalize all the internals when you're doing a play or a movie.
You know, a lot of people who love certain books go to the movies of those books and are disappointed because it just wasn't the book. And you can't do the book on
screen. You can't.
Otherwise, you'd be there forever.
Right.
So it's disappointing sometimes for people who love books and people who love movies to see the different versions. What's it like to be on your side of it, where you've taken a book and you have done the screenplay? Certain things cannot be done. They have to be left on the cutting room floor because it can't be a 10-hour movie.
Right.
What's it like for you? How do you pick and choose? How do you know what's going to work? How do you figure it out?
Well, part of the process is sort of mystical, I think. It's just distilling the essence of the story and putting it in the language of film or the stage. I've done my own books. I've done other people's books. My first principle is first do no harm, kind of like a doctor, and then distill the essence of the story, the essence of the character, and translate that into the language of film or stage. The point of view is different. The point of view with a movie or a play is with a movie is the camera, what the camera sees. The point of view with a play is what the audience sees on stage. The point of view with a book is much more sprawling than that.
So do you find writing for stage or writing for the movies limiting because you can't get inside the head of the character, you can't hear the character think?
No, it's challenging because you find ways to externalize the internals. And then you also have that wonderful collaborative process. You're working with a director and actors and crew who can help you translate that. For example, when we did Home Fires Burning, marvelous cast, Barnard Hughes, Seda Thompson, Neil Patrick Harris, Bill Pullman. I mean, these are really, really terrific people. And the director required them to read the book before they came to the set, and they all did. And I know that those fine actors brought things from their experience of acting and from the book to their portrayal of the characters. So I didn't have to do all the work.
Yeah, because they could distill for themselves the
exactly.
essence of their own characters,
exactly.
having read the characters in the book. Bob Inman is with us. His new book is called The Governor's Lady, and we will talk about that, among other things, as we continue. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Birdhouse on the Greenway, providing holiday shopping with a variety of gifts for bird and nature lovers, bird feeders and baths, binoculars, and birdhouses, bringing people and nature together. BirdhouseOnTheGreenway.com. And the International Collectibles and Antiques Show at Metrolina Expo, presenting the December pre-holiday show tomorrow through Sunday at 7100 Statesville Road. Details at ICAShows.com. Well, Dr. Amy Jill Levine grew up Jewish in a mostly Catholic neighborhood, which led to a fascination for all things New Testament at a very young age. Well, today, she's a professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University's Divinity School, and in that role, she has written several books about Jesus, the New Testament, and misunderstandings of Jesus as a Jew. She will set us straight on all of this and more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the ACLU is suing U.S. Catholic bishops over anti-abortion policies that it claims endanger women's lives, the legal rights of pregnant women at Roman Catholic hospitals.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Bob Inman is our guest. You may remember him from WBTV News. He's gone on to be a novelist, a screenwriter, a playwright, and much more. Joanne on Facebook remembers you. She says, "I've always liked Bob, both as a newsman and a storyteller. Newscasts in Charlotte definitely aren't the same without him." Just thought I'd pass that along to you. You actually have a Master of Fine Arts in writing, creative writing. And I've talked to creative writing teachers about whether or not it's a talent that can be taught. Most of them say, there are principles about it that can be taught. But you grew up in a storytelling family, and you grew up kind of a storyteller, and I'm just curious what those courses in creative life writing did for you that you didn't know before, or how did it change what you do?
Well, this was a 48-hour, semester-hour course at the University of Alabama. Half of it was in academic courses, which were master's and doctoral-level academic courses. And what I did there was read, and I was exposed to things that I didn't read in undergraduate school, even though I was an English minor. I was exposed to a lot of really terrific literature, and you learn from that by osmosis. Not that you're going to copy these people, but that they're going to influence the way you're studying their craft as well as their art. And then the other half was in writing workshops in fiction and poetry. I am not a poet. I don't have the talent for that. But
you're a lyricist. That's close.
Well, a lyricist. Yeah. I rhyme stuff. But the writing workshops, Barry Hanna used to say in fiction writing, I can't teach you to write, but I can nurture what's there. And that's, I think, the approach that a good creative writing teacher takes is to nurture what's there. And I try to do that whenever I do writing workshops, when I lead a workshop, is to nurture what's there, work with the material, not do a lot of preaching, but do a lot of reacting and encouraging.
When you first start out to be a creative writer, whether you're writing short stories or novels or poetry, whatever, it seems to me to be very brave to share that work with anybody.
Yeah,
with a teacher, with a friend, with a wife, with a husband. It would seem to be very brave, because this is your interior coming out on paper.
You're exposing yourself.
Exactly right. What was that like for you, and does it get easier with every book?
It's always been easy for me. You know, I write. I want people to read what I write. I don't share my writing on a new book until the first draft is done. I just don't. I mean, it's lonely, painful work, and I might as well go in the closet and do it and bleed and suffer and have paper cuts and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then I'm ready to come out. You know, you emerge from the cave with this thing in your hand, and you want people to read it.
This is not the first time that you've described writing as lonely, painful work. You've also said you do it one bloody word at a time, and you've used the word sufferer to describe yourself and other writers.
Yeah.
Given all that lovely language, why do you do it?
Well, because you can't not. I mean, it's this disease that you have, an itch that you have to scratch. You know that you have the ability to do this. And you want to share it with people. I can tell, Mike, there's so much I can't do, but this is one thing I can do. And I feel like, it's a contribution. I write stories about people. And if I write something and you read it and you find a character in there that resonates with you, that's the big payoff. And so that's why I do it.
When you come up with a character and a situation and a dilemma for that character to overcome, are you trying to tell us something? Are you trying to teach us something, I guess is the question? Or are you just trying to tell a good yarn?
I'm trying to tell a good yarn and let you take from it what you will. Hopefully there's something of value there for you. Mm-hmm. And I just want to present it. Put it out there. Put the people out there. Put the story out there, and let you take from it what you will. I don't want to teach. I don't want to preach. I don't have an agenda. My only agenda is telling a good story.
Mm. You started your career covering news in Alabama, and particularly covering politics in Alabama. How many of the characters or situations in Governor's Lady, or approaches to the characters or situations, come from that experience and that time of your life?
Well, I've been writing this book in a way since then. When I went to work in Montgomery in 1965, George Wallace was the governor, mm-hmm. and I covered the state capitol for the television station I worked for there. And he was the governor. He had run for president once. He intended to run again in 1968. The legislature would not allow him to serve a second term. So he managed to get his wife, Lurleen, elected governor. It was understood from the get-go that Lurleen was not really going to be the governor. She was keeping the seat warm. She was a stand-in for George.
Because in Alabama, you can't run two consecutive terms.
You can now, but you couldn't then.
So you could skip a term and come back.
Yeah, you could, and which George Wallace eventually did.
Right.
But so he got Lurleen elected, and she was his stand-in. She served a year and a half in office and died of cancer. A fellow named Albert Brewer was the lieutenant governor. He succeeded her, and I was his press secretary for 2.5 years. So all of that went into the well from which I draw the water of a Southern political story. Now, in The Governor's Lady, there is a woman who is elected governor succeeding her husband, who is off running for president. So the germ of the idea for the story came from George and Lurleen Wallace. This is a modern story in The Governor's Lady. It takes place today, mm-hmm. and the characters are vastly different. But the situation that I began with is the same.
I love the names. Cooper Lanier is the new governor.
The new wife, governor.
Mm-hmm. Pickett Lanier is her husband. Very Southern names.
Oh, they are.
Cooper and Pickett.
Exactly. Well, Pickett from the Confederate general who charged up Cemetery Ridge at Gettysburg, and then Lanier, the great Southern poet, Sidney Lanier.
And then her mother is a character by the name of Mickey Spanauer, that's how you say the last name.
That's right.
Who is a feisty, older woman who was a governor's wife, mm-hmm. and who is really into politics.
She's a mastermind.
Yes.
Yeah.
And needs this one last political campaign as a means to reconnect with a daughter from whom she's been estranged, and also just to get her fingers back in the pie.
Yeah.
Do you understand that kind of person, somebody who just can't give it up?
Oh, absolutely. I've been around them for a long time. I mean, behind every successful politician, there is a person who pulls strings and manipulates and knocks heads and raises money and comes up with strategy and tactics about how to run a campaign. And Mickey Spanauer did that for her husband, mm-hmm. who was a two-term governor, and she's done it for other candidates, and now she wants to do it for Cooper.
And there are, as you say, there are people that do that for people who ultimately gain office. That's how they got there, and they are generally taken into the administration in some way and are actually running a lot of stuff. They're making decisions. So these are the unsung, if you want to use the word hero, these are the people behind the scenes who really are powerful people, mm-hmm. but they're not elected. Is that healthy?
Well, it's just a matter of fact. It happens. A lot of times these people who run campaigns, they don't want to serve in an administration. I mean, the serving is dull to them. They want, the game. You know, they're into the game, so they don't. Sometimes they do, but a lot of times they want to go on to the next campaign, and that's what Mickey does. She likes to go on to the next campaign. But she's dying.
Yeah.
She has congestive heart failure, and she's not going to last much longer, and she's hoping this will be her last hurrah.
I want to go back to you for a second when you were the press secretary for the governor who succeeded Lurline, whose name I cannot remember.
Albert Brewer. Yeah.
Albert Brewer, unlike George Wallace, was an integrationist. He believed in integration, and George Wallace is the guy that stood in the doorway and said, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. What was it like to be the press secretary in the Deep South in the late 60s, early 70s for a governor who wanted to integrate everything?
Well, I wouldn't call him an integrationist. He was not hell-bent on changing Alabama overnight. And Alabama in 1968 to 1970 was a very conservative, racially conservative, segregationist
place. That's putting
place.
It nicely.
Yes, at least white Alabama was. He was a progressive man. He favored, for example, freedom of choice in education, in elementary and secondary education, which meant that people could choose where they wanted to go to school. And that was a very radical idea. Hmm. He also was getting ready. He wanted a full term. He served 2.5 years. He wanted a full term. And in 1970, he knew he had to run for a full term. So a lot of what went on during those 2.5 years was always with the upcoming campaign
right.
in mind. He was a progressive. He had a lot of progressive ideas about how state government operated and how education operated and how jobs came in and things like that. But in 1970, he ran, and he had to run against George Wallace, and he lost.
Yeah.
And George Wallace, at the last minute, when it looked like Mr. Brewer might win the campaign, pulled the race card and waved it wildly and won the election.
Yeah. So those 2 years or 2.5 years that you were the press secretary for Governor Brewer, I would think, exposed you to a lot of people and maneuvering and the politics that goes on behind the scenes that we don't really – we may be peripherally aware of it, but we really don't understand it. Is that true?
Well, absolutely. And to me, there's two kinds of politics. One is the politics of election, mm-hmm. and the other is the politics of serving. And they're similar but different. The politics of serving has to do with how you get your ideas brought forth and hopefully adopted. That means dealing with the legislature. It means dealing with constituents. It means dealing with public opinion. And that's all part of the political process.
And it's also dealing in most public officers' cases, it's dealing with what do I have to do to make an impact and be true to myself and be true to the people who voted for me on the one hand. On the other hand, what do I have to do to stay, to get reelected?
It's the art of the possible.
Yeah. Would we be better served if everybody was elected to 1 6-year term and that's it? Then, therefore, you could get in, you could do what you said you wanted to do because you're not going to be reelected because you can't be reelected.
Well, I think the great fly in the ointment in American politics today is money, the influence of money in campaigns, in the way administrations are run. And if term limitations would limit the power of money, mm-hmm. big money I'm talking about, mm-hmm. I think that would be good. Anything that would do that. People talk about big money in politics, and they say, well, that's just freedom of speech. But one of my characters in the book,
Mickey
mm-hmm. says always follow the money,
mm-hmm.
you know, because if you follow the big money, you know where things are going.
I'm trying to find that speech because I saw that yesterday. I can't
yeah. But she also says, and Cooper believes, that sometimes big money can drown out free speech, the free speech of the little guy.
Mm-hmm.
So money's a big and it's an important part of this story. There's some big money behind the scenes going on, some political intrigue that my character Cooper Lanier has to deal with, and that's very much a part of the nuts and bolts of politics.
And one of the things that Mickey says about big money, and she should know because she's been around it, politics her entire adult life, is that a lot of the money is quiet money.
Absolutely quiet money.
And it's the big money, the rich people's money, that's quiet money. They don't care who wins. They don't care whether they're a Republican or a Democrat, a conservative or a liberal. They know how to work with both people to get what they want done quietly.
Exactly.
Does that come from your experience of observing it as a press secretary or just reporting on it as an anchor person or just because you know stuff?
Well, I know it from all of those sources. I mean, when I left Alabama in 1970 to come to Charlotte and take a job, you know, in journalism here, I continued to cover politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the thing that I knew the best and enjoyed covering the most. So all of this is part of that experience that goes into the writing of the book.
The other thing that this book deals with is not just the politics of being in a high office or running for a high office. It's also what it does to the office seeker and the office holder's family.
Yes.
Because it's hard to strike a balance in life when you're such a public figure and when people are saying things about you that are truly vile in many cases. And I'm wondering if this is in some way a fictional exploration of Hillary Clinton, because she is the former wife of a president. She ran for president. She's Secretary of State. She's likely to run for president again. She has a daughter who they tried to protect while they were in the White House, but who's now a public figure. And of course, there's this business of the relationship between Hillary and Bill. I'm wondering if this if some of the ideas for what goes on with Cooper and Pickett comes from that, and
well,
their son,
not directly. I did not have the Clintons in mind when I wrote this book at all, but I've observed political families over time, and I know how difficult that can be for the family. If you're a rock star or a movie star, and you have a family, you have a spouse and kids, you have enough money and enough resources to shield them from the glare of publicity, of public life. If you're a politician, an office seeker, an office holder, you push the family out front. I mean, we've seen it on election night. There's the candidate who is, you know, talking to the crowd about this great victory that he or she has won, and arrayed behind them are the spouse and all the kids. And so it's and I've seen it to be very tough on spouses and kids of politicians,
because the spouse and the children may not want any part of this life.
They may not, and it's difficult. I mean, you're in a fishbowl. People are looking at you all the time, and they are reporting on what you do all the time, for good or ill, and they're also. They will if you let them manipulate you, because you are a conduit to the office holder. So they will use you if they can and if you let them.
Bob Inman is our guest. His newest book is called The Governor's Lady. It's a novel about a new governor of a southern state who takes over for her husband, a former governor who's now running for president, and her mother, who was a former wife of a former governor. It's a pretty interesting story. We're going to come right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC-TV's Winterfest 2013, presenting Britt Floyd live at Red Rocks tonight at 8. Information at unctv.org. And Blumenthal Performing Arts, offering complimentary parking with ticket purchases for select Broadway shows and more during December. Details at blumenthalarts.org/verymerry. Well, the ACLU is suing U.S. Catholic bishops over anti-abortion policies that it claims endanger women's lives. Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about the legal rights of pregnant women at Roman Catholic hospitals coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. As you have probably realized by now, Bob Inman is sitting with us in the studio today. And maybe you remember Bob from being on television. Maybe you've read many or most or all of his books. Maybe you have a question or a comment. Join us. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, and we're coming right back. Stay with us.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week, two men who grew up in the same place but worlds apart demonstrate the power food has to unite us. We take a peek back in time to learn how Queen Victoria ran her kitchen, and we have gift ideas for those eaters and cooks in your life. It's The Splendid Table from APM.
Hope you'll make time for that this Saturday afternoon. It's The Splendid Table, Saturday at 3 at 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Bob Immins, our guest, author, playwright, screenwriter. His books include Home Fires Burning, Dairy Queen Days, Captain Saturday, Old Dogs and Children, a play called The Christmas Bus, which we've talked about on this show. Coming Home, is that a play or a book, or what is Coming Home? That's a nonfiction book.
That's a nonfiction book, collection of my Observer.
Okay, and his latest book is The Governor's Lady, a novel. You were press secretary for the governor of Alabama between George Wallace, well, between Lurleen Wallace and the return of George Wallace.
Right.
Lurleen, as you say, became the governor because George Wallace could not run for a second consecutive term. So she was a figurehead governor. He called the shots. But off the air a minute ago, you called her a lovely, kind woman who did have some ideas of her own. And in your book, Cooper Lanier, who's taking over from Pickett Lanier as governor as he runs for president, I think many people assume in your book that she's going to be that figurehead. But it turns out she is not going to be that figurehead. And she takes the bull by the horns and surprises everybody, most particularly her husband.
Yes, that's right. Well, he's running for president. The stakes are very high. She's a novice. And he assumes that she will be a good little girl and do whatever. He's left her surrounded by his people.
Right.
And he assumes that she will go along with whatever. But she ran for office, and she got elected, and she has her own ideas.
And she's a governor's daughter and a governor's wife, and now the governor. She's not really a novice, is she?
Well, she has the pedigree. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things her mother says to her. Mickey says, you have the pedigree. Use it. And her mother wants her to be a governor in her own right. And she's determined to do so. She's feisty and independent and clever, and she's determined to be relevant.
You've written two very strong and very different women here, Mickey and Cooper, mm-hmm. the mother, Mickey, and Cooper, the daughter who becomes the governor. What's it like? You're a guy. How can you write two strong women and really know what they would be thinking, saying, doing, and feeling?
Well, I was raised by strong women. I'm married to a strong woman, and I just admire strong, feisty, independent women. My grandmother was one. My mother was one. And I just admire them. And when I have somebody like that and turn them loose and let them be all they can be, that is just about as much fun as I have,
well,
as a writer.
In an interview you did with Creative Loafing, you were asked about Cooper Lanier, and you said that you believe the world would be a lot better off when there will be a lot better off when there are more women appointed and elected at every level of government and politics. You said women bring a perspective to it that men generally don't bring. And as I discovered Cooper Lanier, that really came home to me. She could do things that maybe a man could not because of her perspective. But her perspective is your perspective. You put the words into her mouth and the ideas into her head. You gave her her story. So elucidate that, if you would.
Well, I do believe we'll be better off when there are more women involved in every aspect of public life in our country, whether it's the corporate boardroom or cultural institutions, educational institutions, government, and politics. I think women, and I'm going to make a generalization here, I think women look at things and say, what do we need and how can we do it? And they're not so tied to hidebound ideologies, left side or right side, mm-hmm. that they are hell-bent on making their point and getting their victory. They're more practical, I believe. Cooper Lanier is more practical than a man in her place would be.
Now, you've said about her mother, the character Mickey Spanauer, to think of Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah.
So for the if you were thinking, who would I put in the movie of this, you'd put Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah.
So when you wrote that character, were you thinking Shirley MacLaine?
No. No, that came after. I just imagined Mickey as this, you know, as this person. She's crusty. She's profane. She's, she can be mean. She has been in the past.
Yeah.
She's a manipulator. But boy, she knows a lot.
And these are the people you want running the world, is it?
Well, behind the scenes, helping the people who run the world. She brings the practicalities of politics to it. She can give Cooper some good advice and some good guidance. It's up to Cooper to decide what she wants. She's kind of like an editor. You know, Mickey's kind of like the editor there.
Yeah,
Cooper's the writer.
Many of the characters, of the secondary characters in the book, are what you would look at in real life and call hangers-on, people who are up there on the political ladder because they like to be near power. They want to maybe influence power, manipulate power, curry favor because people have power. How do you know so much about these people? Is that because of covering the news, because of being a press secretary to a governor?
Sure. I mean, I've been around them. I know them. These are authentic people. They're there. There is a crusty old newspaper reporter named Wheeler Kincaid who has covered the state capitol. He's a guy who says, I know where all the bodies are buried.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he knows secrets, and he uses them in covering politics. He's fearless. And he wants to quit his job at the paper and go to work for Cooper because he thinks she can be a different kind of governor, a different kind of politician. Well, I've been around people like that. You know, they were – when I covered the state capitol in Montgomery – the press room poker game was all the guys sitting around the table were the Wheeler Kincaids of the world.
Mm. Patty even has an email. Patty, we used to work with Patty. You will know who this is, I think. But she says, I was on the production staff at WBTV in the mid-'80s when Bob was the anchor. I was also going to Belmont Abbey College full-time as an English major, and I would do my English homework between the 6 and 11 o'clock news. And I can't tell you how kind and helpful Bob Inman was to me at the time. He was a very inspirational then and still is now.
Eddie, thank you.
What did you do for Patty?
Well, I don't know, answer questions, I guess, suggest things. You know, I was not long out of graduate school and reading all this great literature, and she was. And I think I even shared some class notes with her. I took – when I was in school, I took almost verbatim notes. So I had these notebooks full of stuff, and I may have shared some of it with her.
The administration of the news department at Channel 3 and of the station, in fact, the ownership – has changed, so the situation there has changed dramatically since you worked there. So I think some things can now be told, and I want you.
Oh boy, here we go.
And I want to know if this is an apocryphal story or this is true. News today, local TV news today, is rat-a-tat. I mean, it's short sound bites. It's short writing by the anchors. It's kind of headline, bang, bang, bang. Here it is. You told stories, and you were from that generation of news anchors that told stories. And I heard through the grapevine, I don't know if this is true or not, that toward the end, they didn't like the way you did the news because they didn't like the way you wrote. And here you are, a guy already writing a book, successfully writing a book, and screenplays, and they didn't like the way you wrote. And I always thought, if that's true, we're in deep, deep trouble here.
Well, I did have some rather monumental clashes with consultants who would come in and suggest the way we might change the way we approached
doing. I hate consultants. I hate them.
Well,
they are stupid.
Well... They're cookie cutter, or the ones that, you know, some of the ones who came through our newsroom were cookie cutter people. If it works in Las Vegas, works in Nashville, it will work here. So do it the same way, and this is your formula for success.
Did you ever ask the background of these people? Because I did.
they all came from, you know, from about, some of them had been news directors, you know, some of them had been actors, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure.
Because I...
They
I,
had some bona fides.
They brought, not all of them.
Not all of them.
They brought some very nice person. She was a very nice person. They brought this person in. I was doing the weather over there. And,
yeah.
Among other things. And they brought this person in. She had all these suggestions about how I should do this. And I just thought all of them were wrong. All of them. And I just finally said, what's your background? Where did you come from? How did you get to be a consultant? Well, I was an English major. And I sent in a resume. I thought, oh, have you ever been on television? No. You ever been on stage? No. What do you know about this? but I digress. Let's move on. You have given credit to a number of people who helped you become a writer. At first, it's the usual suspects. Your mother who read to you, an English teacher who really set you straight on grammar and diagramming sentences. And I had an English teacher that did exactly the same thing. The most valuable experience of my educational life. Period. A librarian mm-hmm. who pushed you in the right direction on what kinds of books to read. But then you mention a math teacher.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I was not all that interested in math. And algebra, you know, I could get through it. But what I discovered with Ms. Hamm was... that I love geometry,
mm-hmm.
and she helped me in my appreciation of geometry. That was the part of math that I liked, and it was I figured out later the reason I liked it was about shapes, and as a storyteller, you're all about shapes, about how things work together, how they're put together, lines and angles of a story. Writing a story is kind of like building a house. You start with the foundation, and then, you know, the sticks go up in the walls and the roof and the windows and the interior stuff, mm-hmm. and that's all geometry. And that math teacher in high school really helped me to understand
that. So do you mean that literally, or is that a metaphor?
Well, I mean, as far as—
Angles and—
Well, it is. I mean, a story has a shape. And you, as you're writing the story, or at least for me, as I write the story, I understand the shape of the story.
It has a pace too,
and
people who are not in broadcasting are probably not as attuned to the clock as you and I have been, because
right.
we have to be. The clock
deadline.
Rules everything. Well, the deadline of getting it on the air at the precise time it has to be on the air,
right.
but then it can't be any longer or any shorter than it was supposed to be, or the show won't end on time, or it will end too soon, and then what are you going to do? So everything has a pace and a flow. Has that followed into novel writing? Because you don't have to come in at 250 pages. You could do 312 if you wanted to, right?
Well, it has an ebb and a flow.
Right.
I mean, you can't go at a breakneck pace with a story all the time. There are times when you need to slow down and think about. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about in the story itself, not the writer, but the story itself. There are times for reflection of the character. You know, the character acts and acts and acts, and then it's time to stop and, well, think about what I'm doing here. Why am I acting this way? What do I want to accomplish?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the internals that, to me, are so much fun about writing a novel.
Home Fires Burning was your first novel. This is an email from a guy named Houston. When Bob Inman's first novel, Home Fires Burning, was published, Doug Robercheck, who, if people don't remember, was the out front guy, he wrote a humor column
yeah.
in the newspaper. He noted a new novel about a failed short order chef entitled Home Fires Burning. Now, that's from Doug. While the Atlanta Journal-Constitution called that book the best small-town novel since To Kill a Mockingbird. When you first read that quote, do you remember what you felt like when you saw it? Because that is immense praise.
I was absolutely blown away by that. I mean, this was my first novel.
Yeah.
I was thrashing around in the underbrush trying to find the path, and I produced this thing, and people really liked it. And when that reviewer Wayne Greenhall in the Atlanta paper said that I thought, well, you know, maybe I've done something okay here.
I've
been true.
Right after that first novel, you were asked to write the screenplay for that novel. That's an extraordinary achievement, it seems to me, because most writers don't get asked to do the screenplay.
Right.
And many writers who have books that are opted to become movies and films for television are essentially given the check and told and summarily dismissed. Don't darken our door. You can come visit the set, but don't say anything because it's not your book anymore.
Right.
How did they come to you? Why did they come to you, a first-time novelist, to do the screenplay?
Well, my agent negotiated with Hallmark as part of the compensation that I would be a story consultant.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant that they would listen to me and then, again, say, go away and let us do what we will with your story. So I decided that I would think about how this 400-page sprawling novel could be done as a two-hour movie. And I wrote an idea and essentially said the novel bounces back and forth from the past to the present. And I took the present-day story and sort of layered in some things from the past and wrote it all down and gave it to them, and they liked it. They said, we like your approach, so we think we'll let you try to write the screenplay. And I did try to write the screenplay, and they liked it, and they used it.
I have 30 seconds left. This weekend was the big Auburn-Alabama game. I know that you're raised in Alabama. You went to the University of Alabama, but you wanted to go to Auburn, and you say the loss against Auburn brings thoughts of self-immolation, a spike in Prozac prescriptions for Alabama fans. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I'm ambivalent. David, I'll be at Park Road Books tomorrow night at 7 o'clock.
All right. To sign his book, The Governor's Lady, his new novel, David Rue, who's now running PBS over here at WTVI, says, thanks for a great program. Bob has been the most influential person in my life.
He's a great friend.
We'll end there.